Welcome to Benefits, What, Like It's Hard? The podcast that breaks down the truths and misconceptions about all things benefits. Not only do we talk about what you should know about the benefits offered to you through your employer, but we also tackle topics on physical and financial wellness. I mean, come on, what more could you want from a podcast? Join me, Libby Allison, each week to hear from people just like you sharing their own experiences and experts giving us the inside scoop on the information we need to be successful. Hi everyone, today we are going to be talking about dependent care FSAs with Anna Fahler. You have all heard from her before. So, hi Anna.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
How's it going today?
It's all right.
Good.
It's Monday.
So what are we going to talk about today?
So we're going to talk a little bit about dependent care FSAs. And as always, when I'm here, it's going to be kind of tax heavy. So we're going to talk about that. And I think I'm going to throw in a little bit about other things you should be thinking about if you're a new parent, just financially.
Okay. I love it.
Okay.
So what's the first thing we should know?
The first thing you should know, so how an FSA works, it's very similar to a healthcare FSA in that if you don't use the funds, you lose the funds. So that's kind of like the big thing to know about these is that you can put money into it, but you gotta use it each year or it goes away. So that's like the big warning. But they're really an awesome tool, and I have two kids, and I use mine to the fullest extent each year. And how it works is that you make pre-tax contributions into the FSA, and the dependent care FSA. So the money basically comes automatically out of your paycheck, doesn't get taxed, it just goes right into the FSA. And then you can use that money later to pay for childcare expenses. So you get a little bit of a tax break there by using the FSA and kind of going through that conduit to pay for the expenses that you would pay for anyways.
Right. So can you talk about how it works? So you put money in, but how do you get it out?
Right. So similar to, say, like a healthcare FSA, in our case, we don't like have a credit card or anything that we can use. But what ours does here, and what I imagine a lot of other places, you simply just submit receipts. So my kids are daycare kids, and so I just typically at the end of the year ask for a receipt for what we've paid, and then I submit that to the provider, and they direct deposit a check into my bank account. So I get that money right back out of that account.
Okay, so you're doing it at the end of the year, not throughout.
Yeah, so you can do it any which way, and like submit the expenses, and then that'll pay you as you go. But yes, I kind of do it at the end of the year, and that's my own sort of little flavor of cash management because it gives me this nice little amount for Christmas. So you've got all these big bills at the end of the year, and you're buying presents and things like that for the holidays, and so that's kind of just how I've handled that. But, you know, certainly there is an argument to have it paid out immediately because it's sitting there and it's not earning anything. You can't invest these accounts. So there is a good argument to get it out faster, but this is sort of my like forced savings, especially because it's only in there for a couple months.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people doing that, not just for dependent care, but for their healthcare FSAs and even sometimes HSAs. They'll wait to submit for reimbursement at the end of the year so they get like a nice little Christmas bonus kind of.
Right, because it's automatically deducted from your paycheck, so you never really see that cash anyways, so it's a nice little savings,
right,
bump to
yeah.
cash flow. Yeah, and you can really use these for a lot of different expenses. The maximum contribution that you can make is $5,000. And anyone who has kids knows that goes very fast. So I use mine for daycare expenses, and then my daughter has after school care, so it goes towards that. It can go to certain summer camp programs. So there's a lot of uses for the dependent care FSA. And certainly if you've got kids that have nannies or in daycare or anything like that, that $5,000 will go very quickly.
Yeah. I believe that you can go to the IRS website too to see all of the eligible expenses under a dependent care account.
That's correct. Yeah. So there's a laundry list of things that'll qualify. So one thing I do want to point out, though, with the dependent care FSA, there's also a dependent care tax credit, and these two play off of each other. So any amount that you have withheld on a pre-tax basis for your dependent care FSA is going to reduce the eligible expenses that you can use to figure your child care tax credit. So those, that list of expenses that you can use your FSA for is the same as that tax credit. And if you use your FSA to reimburse those expenses, it's going to count against what you can use for the credit.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. So that's like the biggest, trickiest part of the dependent care FSA is that there's also this credit that it kind of balances against. So, you know, this is my warning. The tax code is extremely complex. It is never really clear unless you are a tax professional. But to give you kind of the, like, 20,000 foot view of how this works, a credit is a kind of like erasing of the tax due. So if you're credit is, say, $200, that's $200 off the top of your taxes due, all right? The FSA is more of a deduction, which is a different thing in the tax code. It just means I'm deducting from your income. If, say, I take $2,000 off your income, you're still going to apply the tax rates to whatever's left over. And how these two sort of work together, the deduction from your income with the FSA and the credit against the taxes, like I said, it's the same expenses that kind of go into the calculation. And really that credit is going to be better for you if you are in a lower tax bracket. And the deduction is going with the FSA is going to be better if you're in a higher tax bracket. So it's some math involved there. To see, you know, first of all, how much expenses do I've got, and what tax bracket am I in? What's going to get me the better result? So I don't know if we want to go into the weeds at all with
this. Well, how would you? I wouldn't even know how to do that.
Yeah. So I wrote out a little example.
Perfect.
So the credit is on if you have one child, the credit's on 3,000 of qualifying expenses. And so that's going to be between $600 and $1,050. So that's kind of the range that your credit's going to be. So it's either 35 to 20%. If you have more than one child, the maximum expenses that you can look at are $6,000. So that's going, the credit you're going to get is between $1,200 and $2,100. That's the credit. So off of your tax bill, you'll get that depending on how many kids you have, what your income is, and so on. So now, like I said, the FSA sort of interacts with those eligible expenses. So say if you have one kid and you make that $5,000 contribution to the FSA, well, you've just completely wiped out any ability to take the credit, right? So the maximum expenses you can use for the credit is $3,000, and you've just used up $5,000 of that, so there's nothing left over for the credit. Right? If you have one kid, you're maxing out the FSA, you're not going to get any credit. If you have two children or more, you can max out that FSA at $5,000, but the maximum expenses you can use for the credit is $6,000, so you still have $1,000 of expenses that you can use to figure the credit. right. So my example, and this is kind of from my own family. I've got two kids, 24% marginal tax bracket. If I use the credit, I'd get $1,200 off our tax bill. So I'd have $6,000 of eligible expenses. I can get a 20% credit back, so $1,200. If we use the FSA, and that's what we do, we put a whole $5,000 in that. So I'm in the 24% tax bracket. So you take $5,000 off of my income, and that at 24% is $1,200. So right there, we're equal. But because I have that extra $1,000 limit on the credit, I get an extra $200, so 20% of $1,000. So overall, I'm saving $200 in income taxes by blending the FSA and the credit, right? But that, because I use the FSA, I can't use that whole $6,000 in the credit. So that's kind of the trade-off. If you're, say, in a lower income tax bracket, so say you're in the 12% bracket, and even at the top end of that bracket, you're going to hit that that credit goes down to 20% of your expenses. So say you have two kids, $6,000 of expenses, the credit's $1,200. If you did the FSA, you're going to have $5,000, 12% of that is $600. So that's basically a $600 reduction in tax. And the remaining credit is only $200. So it's $1,200 if you did the straight credit. It's $800 if you did a combination of the FSA and the credit. So if you're in a lower income tax bracket, typically makes sense to forego the FSA and take the credit. So that is the very tricky part of all of this, is that there is this credit out there. The tax code is very complex. So my warning is, you know, if you're extremely confused about this, go see a tax professional. They can do the math and help you figure it out. And, you know, typically you'll have, once you get the answer, it'll probably stay the same answer every year until your family situation changes. So it's not necessarily something you have to revisit every year.
Right.
But it can be worth, you know, taking a look at and doing the math on that. So I think the child care FSA is a really great tool, but it might not be the optimal from a tax perspective, especially if you're in a lower income tax bracket.
Yeah. I had no idea that you even got a tax credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's just, I don't have kids, so maybe that's why I don't know that. But I had no idea. So for me, I never knew that you would need to decide what makes the most sense for you based on where you fall. So
yes.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's one of those tidbits that I think most people don't really know is out there. And I've had a couple of people around the office that come to me at the end of the year, like, how does this work again? Which one do I want? So, because it is confusing, and you don't really know it until you're in it and what having a child means from a tax perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
Anything else we should know?
More on taxes if you have a kid. So, we had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act at the end of 2017, and that did away with personal exemptions. So it used to be that every person in your household would get this exemption, and that would count against your income. So you get like a freebie, several thousand dollars of income for a deduction there. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act did away with that, but it did include an expanded credit just for having a child. So whether you have child care expenses or not doesn't matter for this credit. So the child tax credit, it's $2,000 per child, and it's a credit, so it goes against your income tax liability directly. And what the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act did was phased out, the credit phases out over when your income gets over $400,000. So it used to be a much lower amount, but it's increased that. So once your income's over $400,000, that credit starts to fade away, but that's a pretty high dollar amount for the average American. So we get those child tax credits as well. So you do get a little break even though those exemptions are gone.
So it's $2,000 no matter what, unless you're over that $400,000 mark.
Kid. Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, does it dwindle down based on how much you make?
Right.
Or, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It phases out over that. So that's kind of the other break in the tax code for having a kid.
Nice. Didn't know about that either. Right now, it's just me on my taxes.
Well, kids are expensive, so it's kind of like a consolation price. You're going to end up spending a lot more than that.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So a couple other things I did want to mention about what people should be thinking about when they're having kids financially is estate planning. It's really not something that's just meant for ultra rich people, right? To have an estate, you think of like the Monopoly man and his top hat. No, if you have a child especially, it's really important to have your estate planning documents in place, particularly having a will that names a guardian. So if you and your partner pass away, who's going to take care of the kids? This is something you want to decide by putting it in a will instead of having the courts decide it for you, because they're not going to have the same considerations that you as an individual would have. So that's very important, at least to have a will that names guardians for the kid. And then there's other estate documents out there. If you do have significant assets, or there would be life insurance or things like that, a trust is a wonderful thing to have if you have children. My husband and I have one, specifically because if something were to happen to us, there would be a decent amount of life insurance that we don't want our kids to have when they turn 18.
Right.
We'd rather them be a little older and through school and have some more structure with how they'd get that money. So we have a trust in place for that purpose. And it really only comes into play if we were both deceased. So trust should also not be thought of as just something for extremely wealthy people. they're good for many, many other things. So those are kind of some estate document considerations that you should be thinking about when you have kids, is I need these in place. And the other thing I think is really important is life insurance. It's one thing if you're a single person and you pass away and you're not really responsible for anybody else. When you do become financially responsible for other people, it's important to have life insurance in place to protect them if you can't earn anything if you've passed away. At the bottom range of how much life insurance I should have, I like to think covering college expenses, if that's an important thing to you, education, and if you have a mortgage, covering that so that, you know, your spouse at least, or partner or whatever, has a place to live with the kids, that the kids have a place to live, that it's paid for, that pressure's off their shoulders, and that if you had education goals for them, that's covered as well and taking that pressure off. So at least you get those boxes checked off. That's kind of the minimal insurance you should have. On the higher end, you can think of how do I like completely replace my earnings and financially replace me so that my surviving family has the same lifestyle. That's gonna be more insurance. You can think of how do we just replace our spending needs. That's going to be a little less insurance. Often, term insurance is fine to cover this. So there's two types of insurance. There's term, which really says you're going to get this benefit if you die within this window of time. So say 10 to 20 years. And that's kind of what you're ensuring when you have kids, is that time when they're still kids and not adults and should be able to take care of themselves financially. And then there's also permanent insurance, which is meant to be, as it says, permanent. It lasts your entire lifetime, however long that would be. Permanent insurance tends to be expensive because of that, because it doesn't end, and because it also kind of accumulates this cash value, which you can think of as an investment. So really, when we're talking about financially protecting your children and your partner while they are young, term insurance is typically what you want. It's going to be less expensive as well, which is always a good thing.
And typically your employer offers you term mm-hmm. insurance or the option to buy it.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily something you have to, like, go out to an insurance broker and find. If you have, you know, your basic group term, and then there's often, you know, you can buy in additional term insurance through your employer. That's pretty common, without having to go through underwriting up to a point. Certainly, you know, if you're getting millions of dollars of term insurance, you're going to have to go through underwriting, which, right. You know, if you're young and healthy, shouldn't really be too big of a problem. The other thing I'll say about life insurance, you know, I think it is, especially if you're going beyond what your work is providing as a group benefit, work with a professional, get their opinion on how much you need, but also make sure that you know how that professional is paid, and you don't necessarily want them pushing a product on you that you don't need. Their first thought about insurance should be, how much do you really need and why, and not a commission.
Right.
So that's also very important to know who you're working with and how they're compensated.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other words of advice for us?
No, that's kind of it. You know, there's also college, which is sort of the other thing that is on a lot of parents' minds, but I think that's a whole nother episode into itself. So,
totally.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. I personally learned a lot when it comes to taxes and what you should be thinking about when I do eventually decide to have a family. So thanks for coming. I thought this was great.
Good. I'm glad you found it helpful, and I'm happy to be on the podcast again.
So now it's time to break down the truths and misconceptions. What are the misconceptions we learned from this?
I'd say that the first misconception is that the FSA, the dependent care FSA, is the best hands-down choice if you have dependent care expenses. You really need to look at what tax bracket you're in, because it does play in with that child care credit. So, you know, rule of thumb, if you're in a lower tax bracket, the credit's probably going to do better for you. If you're in a higher tax bracket and have a higher income, you're probably going to be better off using the FSA. My other misconception really comes from the world of Harry Potter, which is that your godparents get your children. So if something were to happen to you, that your godparents would be the ones to take control and take good care of your kids. And certainly they can play a role in them, but godparents do not have legal rights to children. And that's where wills come in, and that's where you do give legal rights to whoever you want to be guardian of your child should something happen to you. And that's really plays into the first truth that I have for this, is that estate planning is for everyone. You don't need some massive estate to do planning. So having a will that names, you know, who's going to be guardian of your children, who gets your assets when you pass away, and gives you that control over having the state determine that, that's for everybody. And my other truth is really about that dependent care FSA. The maximum per year is $5,000. There are lists of how you can use that those money, those funds online from the IRS for those qualified care expenses. And really it is use it or lose it. So I think hitting that $5,000 is pretty easy, especially if you have more than one child in care. But make sure that your expenses are enough to cover that amount that you put in there each year, because it's use it or lose it.
See you next time. Horan Securities Incorporated is a registered broker-dealer and a registered investment advisor, member of FINRA and SIPC. Horan Wealth and Horan Capital Advisors are both SEC-registered investment advisors. The information in this podcast has been obtained from sources believed to be reliable, but we cannot assure its accuracy or completeness. Neither the information nor any opinion expressed constitutes a solicitation for the purchase or sale of any security. Any reference to past performance is not to be implied or construed as a guarantee of future results. Market conditions can vary widely over time, and there is always the potential of losing money when investing in securities.